rising tide of colour against white world supremacy by Lothrop Stoddart. Part 6. The Red Man's World. Part 2. New conflicts are looming on the horizon. The Indian masses, so docile to the genuine white man, are beginning to stir. The aureole of white prestige has been besmirched by the near whites and half-castes who have traded so recklessly upon its sanctions. Strong in the poise of normal heredity, the Indian full-blood commences to despise these chaotic masters who turn his homelands into beer gardens and witches' sabbaths. An Indianista movement is today on foot throughout mongrel-ruled America. It is most pronounced in Mexico, whose interminable agony becomes more and more a war of Indian resurgence, but it is also starting along the west coast of South America. Long ago, wise old Professor Pearson saw how the wind was blowing, noting how whites and near-whites were everywhere fighting and intriguing for the spoils of office. He also noted that the Indian masses, though relatively passive and seemingly unobservant, were yet conquering a place for themselves in other ways than by increasing and multiplying. And he concluded, the general level of the autochthonous race is being raised. It is acquiring riches and self-respect, and must sooner or later get the country back into its hands. Recent visitors to the South American West Coast note the signs of Indian unrest. Some years ago, Lord Bryce remarked of Bolivia, quote, "There have been Indian risings, and firearms are more largely in their hands than formerly. They so preponderate in numbers that any movement which united them against the upper class might, could they find a leader, have serious consequences." Close quote. Still more recently, Professor Ross wrote concerning Peru, "In Cuzco, I met a gentleman of education and travel, who is said to be the only living lineal descendant of the Incas. He has great bitterness with the native element, and voices their bitterness and their aspirations. He declares that the politics of Peru is a struggle between the Spanish mestizos of Lima and the coast, and the natives of Cuzco and the interior, and predicts an uprising unless Cuzco is made the capital of the nation. He even dreams of a Quechua Republic, with Cuzco as its capital, and the United States its guarantor, as she is guarantor of the Cuban Republic." And of Bolivia, Professor Ross writes, "Lately, there has been a general movement of the Bolivian Indians for the recovery of the lands of which they have been robbed piecemeal. Conflicts have broken out, and although the government has punished the ringleaders, there is a feeling that, so long as the exploiting of the Indian goes on, Bolivians are living in the crater of a slumbering volcano." Since the white man is gone, and the Indian is preparing to wrest the scepter of authority from the mongrels' worthless hands, let us examine this Indian race to see what potentiality it possesses of restoring order and initiating progress. To begin with, there can be no doubt that the Indian is superior to the Negro. The Negro, even when quickened by foreign influences, never built up anything approaching a real civilization, whereas the Indian, though entirely sundered from the rest of mankind, evolved genuine polities and cultures like the Aztec of Mexico, the Inca of Peru, and the Maya of Yucatan. The Indian thus possesses creative capacity to an appreciable degree. However, that degree seems strictly limited. The researches of archaeologists have sadly discounted the glowing tales of the conquistadors and the empires of Mexico and Peru, though far from contemptible, certainly rank well below the achievements of European and Asiatic races in medieval and even in classic times. The Indian possesses notable stability and poise, but the very intensity of these qualities fetters his progress and renders questionable his ability to rise to the modern plane. His conservatism is immense. With incredible tenacity, he clings to his ancestral ways and exhibits a dull indifference to alien innovation. Of course, the Indian sub-races differ considerably among themselves, but the same fundamental tendencies are visible in all of them, says Professor Ellsworth Huntington, quote, "The Indians are very backward. They are dull of mind and slow to adopt new ideas. Perhaps in the future they will change, but the fact that they have been influenced so little by 400 years of contact with the white man does not afford much ground for hope. Judging from the past, there is no reason to think that their character is likely to change for many generations. Those who dwell permanently in the white man's cities are influenced somewhat, but here, as in other cases, the general tendency seems to be to revert to the original condition as soon as the special impetus of immediate contact with the white man is removed." Close quote. And Lord Rice writes in a similar vein, quote, "With plenty of stability, they lack initiative. They make steady soldiers and fight well under white or mestizo leaders, but one seldom hears of a pure Indian accomplishing anything or rising either through war or politics or in any profession above the level of his class." Close quote. The truth about the Indian seems to be substantially this. Left alone, he would probably have continued to progress, albeit much more slowly than either white or Asiatic peoples. But the Indian was not left alone. On the contrary, he was suddenly felled by brutal and fanatical conquerors who uprooted his native culture and plunged him into abject servitude. The Indian's spiritual past was shorn away, and his evolution was perverted, prevented from developing along his own lines, and constitutionally incapable of adapting himself to the ways of his Spanish conquerors. The Indian vegetated, learned nothing, and forgot much that he knew. This has continued for 400 years. Is it not likely that his ancestral aptitudes have atrophied or decayed? Slavery and mental sloth have indeed scarred him with their fell stigmata, says Garcia Calderon, quote, "Without sufficient food, without hygiene, a distracted and laborious beast, he decays and perishes. To forget the misery of his daily lot, he drinks, becomes an alcoholic, and his numerous progeny present the characteristics of degeneracy." Close quote. Furthermore, the Indian degenerates from another cause, mongrelization. Miscegenation is a dual process. It works upwards and downwards at one and the same time. In Latin America, hybridization has been prodigious, the hybrids today numbering millions. In some regions, as in Venezuela and parts of Central America, there are very few full-blooded Indians left, hybrids forming practically the entire population. Now, on the whole, the white or mestizo crossing seems hurtful to the Indian, for what he gains in intelligence, he more than loses in character. But the mestizo crossing is not the worst. There is another, much graver racial danger. The hot coastlands swarm with Negroes, and the Zambo, or Negro Indian, is universally adjudged the worst of all matings. Thus, for the Indian, white blood appears harmful, while black blood is absolutely fatal. Yet the mongrelizing tide sweeps steadily on. The Indian draws no color line and continually impairs the purity of his blood and the poise of his heredity. Bearing all the above facts in mind, can we believe the Indian capable of drawing mongrel-ruled America from its slough of despond? Can he set it on the path of orderly progress? It does not seem possible. Assuming, for the sake of argument, complete freedom from foreign intervention, the Indian might in time displace his Mongol rulers, provided he himself were not also Mongolized. But the present Indianista movement is not a sign of Indian political efficiency, nor the harbinger of an Indian renaissance. It is the instinctive turning of the harried beast upon his tormentor, maddened by the cruel vagaries of mongrel rule, and increasingly conscious of the mongrel's innate worthlessness. The Indian at last bares his teeth. Under civilized white tutelage, the Indianista movement would have been practically inconceivable. However, guesses as to the final outcome of an Indian-Mongrel conflict are academic speculation, because Mongrel America will not be left to itself. Mongrel America cannot stand alone. Indeed, it never has stood alone, for it has always been bolstered up by the Monroe Doctrine. But for our protection, outside forces would have long since rushed into this political and economic vacuum, and every omen today denotes that this vacuum, like all others, will presently be filled. A world close packed as never before will not tolerate countries that are a torment to themselves and a dangerous nuisance to their neighbours. A world half bankrupt will not allow vast sources of potential wealth to lie in hands which idle or misuse. Thus, it is practically certain that Mongol America will presently pass under foreign tutelage. Exactly how is not yet clear. It may be done by the United States alone, or, what is more probable, in pan-American cooperation with the lusty young white nations of the Antipodean South. It may be done by an even larger combination, including some European states. After all, the details of such action do not lie within the scope of this talk, since they fall exclusively within the white man's sphere of activity. There is, however, another dynamic which might transform Mongrel America. This dynamic is Yellow Asia. The Far East teems with virile and laborious life. It thrills to novel ambitions and desires. Avid with the urge of swarming myriads, it hungrily seeks outlets for its superabundant vitality. We have already seen how the Mongolian has earmarked the whole Far East for his own, and in subsequent pages we shall see how he also beats restlessly against the white world's race frontiers. But Mongrel America? What other field offers such tempting possibilities for Mongolian race expansion? Vast regions of incalculable unexploited wealth, sparsely inhabited by stagnant populations, cursed with anarchy and feeble from miscegenation, how could such lands resist the onslaught of tenacious and indomitable millions? The answer is self-evident. They could not resist, and such an invasion once begun would be consummated with a severity and thoroughness perhaps unexampled in human history. Now the Yellow World is alive to this momentous possibility. Japan in particular has glimpsed in Latin America precious avenues to that racial expansion, which is the keynote of Japanese foreign policy. For years, Japanese statesmen and publicists have busied themselves with the problem. The Chinese had, in fact, already pointed the way, for during the later decades of the 19th century, Chinamen frequented Latin America's Pacific coast, economically vanquishing the natives with ease and settling in Peru in such numbers that the alarmed Peruvians hastily stopped the inflow by drastic exclusion acts. The successes of these Chinese pioneers, humble coolies, entirely without official backing, have fired the Japanese imagination. The Japanese press has long discussed Latin America in optimistic vein. Count Okuma is a good exemplar of these Japanese aspirations. Some years ago, he told the American sociologist Professor Ross, "South America, especially the northern part, will furnish ample room for our surplus." To his fellow countrymen, Count Okuma was still more specific. In 1907, he stated in the Tokyo Economist that the Japanese were to overspread the earth like a cloud of locusts, alighting on the North American coasts and swarming into Central and South America. Count Okuma expressed a strong preference for Latin American countries as fields for Japanese immigration, because most of them were much easier to include within the sphere of influence of Japan in the future. And the Japanese have supplemented words with deeds, especially since 1914. Japanese activity in Latin America has been ubiquitous and striking. The west coast of South America, in particular, is today flooded with Japanese goods, merchants, commercial missions, and financial agents seeking concessions of every kind. Our State Department has had to exercise special vigilance concerning Japanese concession hunting in Mexico. Japan's present activity is, of course, mere reconnoitering, testings and mappings of terrain for possible later action on a more extensive scale. One thing alone gives Japan pause: our veto. Japan knows that real aggression against our southern neighbours would spell war with the United States. Japan does not contemplate war with us at present. She has many fish to fry in the Far East. So in Latin America, she plays safe, but she bides her time. In Latin America itself, she has friends, even partisans. Japan seeks to mobilize to her profit that distrust of the Yankee which permeates Latin America. The half-castes, in particular, rage at our color line and see in the United States the nemesis of their anarchic misrule. They flout the Monroe Doctrine, caress dreams of Japanese aid, and welcome Nippon's pose as the champion of color throughout the world. Japanese activities in Mexico are of a special interest. Here, Japan has three strong strings to her bow. 1. Patriotic dislike of the United States. 2. Mestizo hatred of the white gringo. 3. The Indianista movement. In Mexico, the past decade of revolutionary turmoil has developed into a complicated race war of the mestizos against the white or near-white upper class, and of the Indian full-bloods against both whites and mestizos. The one bond of union is dislike of the gringo, which often rises to fanatical hatred. Our war against Mexico in 1847 has never been forgotten, and many Mexicans cherish hopes of revenge and even aspire to recover the territories then ceded to us. During the early stages of the European War, our military unpreparedness and apparent pacifism actually emboldened some Mexican hotheads to concoct the notorious Plan of San Diego. The conspirators plotted to rouse the Mexican population of our southern border, sow disaffection among our southern Negroes, and explode the mine at the psychological moment by means of a reconquering equitable army invading Texas. Our whole southwest was to be rejoined to Mexico, while our southern states were to form a black republic. The projected war was conceived strictly in terms of race, the reconquering equitable army to be composed solely of Latins, Negroes, and Japanese. The racial results were to be decisive, for the entire white population of both our South and Southwest was to be pitilessly massacred. Of course, the plot completely miscarried, and sporadic attempts to invade Texas during 1915 were easily repulsed. Nevertheless, this incident reveals the trend of many Mexican minds. The framers of the Plan of San Diego were not ignorant peons, but persons of some standing. The outrages and tortures inflicted upon numerous Americans in Mexico during recent years are further indications of that widespread hatred which expresses itself in vitriolic outbursts like the following editorial of a Mexican provincial paper, written during our chase after the bandit Villa in 1916. Quote, "Above all, do not forget that at a time of national need, humanity is a crime, and frightfulness is a virtue. Pull out eyes, snatch out hearts, tear open breasts. Drink, if you can, the blood in the skulls of the invaders from the cities of Yankeeland. In defense of liberty, be a Nero, be a Caligula, that is, to be a good patriot. Peace between Mexico and the United States will be closed in throes of terror and barbarism." Close quote. All this is naturally grist for the Japanese mill. Especially interesting are Japanese attempts to play upon Mexican Indianista sentiment. Japanese writers point out physical and cultural similarities between the Mexican native races and themselves, deducing therefore innate racial affinities springing from the remote and forgotten past. All possible sympathetic changes were rung during the diplomatic mission of Señor de la Barra to Japan at the beginning of 1914. His reception in Tokyo was a memorable event. Señor de la Barra was greeted by cheering multitudes, and on every occasion the manifold bonds between the two peoples were emphasized. This, of course, occurred before the European War. During the war, Japanese-Mexican relations remained amicable. So far as official evidence goes, the Japanese government has never entered into any understandings with the Mexican government, though some Mexicans have hinted at a secret agreement, and one Mexican writer, Gutierrez de Lara, asserts that in 1912, Francisco Madero, then president, threw himself into the arms of Japan. He goes on, quote, "We are well aware of the importance of this statement and of its tremendous international significance, but we make it deliberately with full confidence in our authority. Not only did Madero enlist the ardent support of the South American republics in the cause of Mexico's inviolability, but he entered into negotiations with the Japanese minister in Mexico City for a close offensive and defensive alliance with Japan to checkmate United States aggression. When during the fateful 12 days battle in Mexico City, a rumor of American intervention, more alarming than usual, was communicated to Madero, he remarked coldly that he was thoroughly anxious for that intervention, for he was confident of the surprise the American government would receive in discovering that they had to deal with Japan." Close quote. But, after all, an official Japanese-Mexican understanding is not the fundamental issue. The really significant thing is Mexican popular antagonism to the United States, which is so widespread that Japan could, in a crisis, probably count on a Mexican benevolent neutrality, if not on a Mexican support. The present Carranza government of Mexico is, of course, notoriously anti-American. Its consistent policy, notably revealed in its complacence towards Germany and its intrigues with other anti-American regimes like those of Colombia and Venezuela, makes Mexico the center of anti-Americanism in Latin America. As for the numerous Japanese residents in Mexico, they have lost no opportunity to abet this attitude. Here, for instance, is the text of a manifesto signed by prominent members of the Japanese colony during the American-Mexican crisis of 1916. Quote, "Japanese, Mexico is a friendly nation. Our commercial bonds with her are great. She is, like us, a nation of heroes who will never consent to the world domination of a hard and brutal race as are the Yankees. We cannot abandon Mexico in her struggle against a nation supposedly stronger. The Mexicans know how to defend themselves, but there is lacking aid which we can furnish. If the Yankees invade Mexico, if they seize the California coasts, Japanese commerce and the Japanese Navy will face a grave peril. The Yankees believe us impotent because of the European war, and we will be expelled from American soil, and our children from American schools. We will aid the Mexicans. We will aid Mexico against Yankee rapacity. This great and beautiful country is a victim of Yankee hatred towards Japan. Our indifference would be a lack of patriotism, since the Yankees already are against us and our divine emperor. They have seized Hawaii. They have seized the Philippine Islands near our coasts and are now about to crush underfoot our friend and possible ally and injure our commerce and imperil our naval power. Close quote. The fact is that Latin America's attitude towards the yellow world tends everywhere to crystallize along racial lines. The half-castes, naturally hostile to the United States, see in Japan a welcome offset to the colossus of the North. The self-conscious Indianista elements likewise heed Japanese suggestions of ethnic affinity. On the other hand, the whites and the near-whites instinctively react against Japanese advances. Even those who have no love for the Yankee see in the Mongolian the greatest of perils. Garcia Calderon typifies this point of view. He dreads our imperialistic tendencies, yet he reproves those Latin Americans who in a Japanese-American clash would favour Japan. Victorious, he writes, the Japanese would invade Western America and convert the Pacific into a vast closed sea, closed to foreign ambitions, Mare Nostrum, peopled with Japanese colonies. The Japanese hegemony would not be a mere change of tutelage for the nations of America. In spite of essential differences, the Latins oversea have certain common ties with the people of the United States. A long-established religion, Christianity, and a coherent European Occidental civilization. Perhaps there is some obscure fraternity between the Japanese and the American Indians, between the yellow men of Nippon and the copper-coloured Quechuas, a disciplined and sober people. But the ruling race, the dominant type of Spanish origin, which imposes the civilization of the white man upon America, is hostile to the entire invading East. White men throughout Latin America generally echo these sentiments. Chile and Argentina repulse Oriental immigration, and the white oligarchs of Peru dread keenly Japanese designs directed so specifically against their country. Very recently, a Peruvian doctor, Jorge M. Corbacho, wrote most bitterly about the Japanese infiltration into Peru and adjacent Bolivia, while some years ago, Senior Augustin Edwards, owner of the leading Chilean periodical, El Mercurio, denounced Count Okuma's menaces and called for a pan-American rampart against Asia from Bering Strait to Cape Horn. Japanese immigration, asserted Senior Edwards, must be firmly opposed, not only in South America, but in the whole American continent. The same remark applies to Chinese immigration. In short, these threats of Okuma should induce the nations of South America to adopt the Monroe Doctrine, an invincible weapon against the plans and intentions of that empire of the Orient, which has so lately risen up to new life and already manifests so dire a greed of conquest. From Central America, similar voices arise. A Salvadorian writer urges political federation with the United States as the sole refuge against the yellow peril, to avoid becoming slaves and utterly insignificant, and a well-known Nicaraguan politician, Senior Moncada, writes in similar vein. The momentous implications of Mongolian pressure upon Latin America are admirably described by Professor Ross. Quote, provided that no barrier be interposed to the inflow from man-stifled Asia, he says, it is well within the bounds of probability that by the close of this century, South America will be the home of 20 or 30 millions of Orientals and descendants of Orientals. But Asiatic immigration of such volume would change profoundly the destiny of South America. For one thing, it would forestall and frustrate that great immigration of Europeans, which South American statesmen are counting on to relieve their countries from a schizo unprogressiveness and a misgovernment. The white race would withhold its increase or look elsewhere for outlets, for those with a higher standard of comfort always shun competition with those of a lower standard. Again, large areas of South America might cease to be parts of Christendom. Some of the republics there might come to be as dependent upon Asiatic powers as the Cuban Republic is dependent upon the United States. Close quote. Very pertinent is Professor Ross's warning as to the fate of the Indian population, a warning which Indianista believers in Japanese affinity should seriously take to heart. Whatever might be the lot of the Latin American whites, Professor Ross points out that an Asiatic influx would seal the doom of the Indian element in these countries. The Indians could make no effective economic stand against the wide-awake, resourceful and aggressive Japanese or Chinese. The Oriental immigrants could beat the Indians at every point, block every path upward, and even turn them out of most of their present employments. In great part, the Indians would become a cringing Shudra caste, tilling the poorer lands and confined to the menial or repulsive occupations, filled with despair, and abandoning themselves even more than they do now to pesco and coca, they would shrivel into a numerically negligible element in the population. Such are the underlying factors in the Latin American situation. Once more, we see the essential instability of mere political phenomena. Once more, we see the supreme importance of race. No conquest could have been completer than that of the Spaniards 4 centuries ago. The Indians were helpless as sheep before the mail-clad conquistadors, and military conquest was succeeded by complete political domination. The Indian even lost his cultural heritage and became a passive tool in the hands of his white masters, but the Spaniard did not seal his title deed with the indelible signet of race. Indian blood remained numerically predominant, and the conqueror further weakened his tenure by bringing in black blood, the most irreducible of ethnic factors. The inflow of white blood was small, and much of what did come lost itself in the dismal swamp of miscegenation. Lastly, the whites quarrelled among themselves. The result was inevitable. The colonial whites triumphed only by aid of the half-castes, who promptly claimed their reward. A fresh struggle ensued, ending, save in the Antipodean regions, in the triumph of the half-castes. But these, in turn, had called in the Indians and the Negroes. Furthermore, the half-castes recklessly squandered the white political heritage, so the coloured full-bloods stirred in their turn, and a new movement began, which, if allowed to run its natural course, might result in complete de-Aryanization. In other words, the white race has been going back, and Latin America has been getting more Indian and Negro for the past 100 years. This cycle, however, now nears its end. Latin America will be neither red nor black. It will ultimately be either white or yellow. The Indian is patently unable to construct a progressive civilization. As for the Negro, he has proved as incapable in the New World as in the Old. Everywhere his presence has spelled regression, and his one New World field of triumph, Haiti, has resulted in an abysmal plunge to the jungle level of Guinea and the Congo. Thus is created a political vacuum, and this vacuum unerring nature makes ready to fill. The Latin American situation is, indeed, akin to that of Africa. Latin America, like Africa, cannot stand alone. An inexorable dilemma impends, white or yellow. The white man has been first in the field and holds the central coloured zone between two strong bases, north and south, where his tenure is the unimpeachable title of race. The yellow man has to conquer every step, though he has already acquired footholds and has behind him the welling reservoirs of Asia. Nevertheless, white victory in Latin America is sure, if internecine discord does not rob the white world of its strength. In Latin America, as in Africa, therefore, the whites must stand fast and stand together.